This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the August 2022 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from Education Week titled Stress, Harassment, Censorship: What Educators Face as Politics Roils Schools, by Madeline Will, posted August 10th, 2022. Political debates making their way into school buildings have been a big source of stress for educators, a newly released nationally representative survey confirms. In fact, principals are three times more likely than other working adults to consider the intrusion of politicized issues, such as COVID-19 mitigation or classroom conversations about race, to be a job-related stressor. 61% of principals and 37% of teachers surveyed by the RAND Corporation reported experiencing harassment about these politicized topics, which contributed to burnout, frequent job-related stress, and symptoms of depression. The results, which come from a survey of 2,360 teachers and 1,540 principals that was conducted in January and February, show how educators have landed at the center of political and cultural debates, often with little support or guidance. And there are signs this contention has led to a chilling effect. One in four teachers have been told to stay away from conversations about political and social issues in class. Teachers are having to manage all of these different beliefs of the people around them, administrators, their fellow staff members, the students themselves, or their students' families, said Ashley Wu, an assistant policy researcher at RAND and an author of the report. Educators could use additional support on how to manage these challenging conversations and sometimes these contentious and sensitive topics. While the question of how educators teach LGBTQ issues and handle issues such as gender pronouns, transgender students' participation in school sports, and bathrooms has become highly politicized in recent months, the RAND survey didn't focus on that. Most of the questions centered on how educators felt about classroom conversations about race and COVID-19 mitigation measures. 17 states have imposed bans and restrictions on how teachers can discuss racism and sexism, either through legislation or other avenues, according to an Education Week analysis. At the time of the survey, these restrictions were in place in 14 states. More than half of teachers and principals disagreed with legal limits on classroom conversations about racism, sexism, and other contentious issues, while about a fifth of the educators were in favor of those restrictions. The rest weren't sure. Social studies teachers, who are tasked with teaching the nation's complicated history with race, were significantly more likely than teachers of other subjects to oppose the restrictions. And educators of color were more likely to oppose legal restrictions than their white peers. 62% of principals of color and 59% of teachers of color opposed the bans, compared with 51% of white principals and 52% of white teachers. The RAND survey found that 60% of teachers and 65% of principals believe in the existence of systemic racism, which was defined in the survey as the notion that racism is embedded into systems and structures throughout society rather than present only in interpersonal interactions. 20% of educators don't believe systemic racism exists. Educators of color, and especially black educators, are more likely to believe in its existence. 87% of black teachers say systemic racism is real, compared to 57% of white teachers. This points to an area where we can continue to develop educator mindsets. Preparation and professional learning are some natural avenues to begin to do that, Wu said. The RAND survey found that educators who thought systemic racism is real are much more likely to oppose legal limits on classroom conversations about race. The section is called Confusion Abounds with Little Guidance. About a quarter of teachers overall said they have been told to limit conversations about political and social issues in class. And the data suggest that the race-related laws are having an impact on teaching. 31% of teachers in those states with restrictions have been directed by their administrator to stay away from those topics, compared with 21% of teachers in states without restrictions. Educators have said their administrators are fearful of complaints, both from parents and from the state. Already, the Oklahoma State Board of Education has downgraded the accreditation of two school districts in the state for violating the law that restricts classroom conversations on race and racism and bans diversity training for teachers. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. This next article comes from U.S. News, and it's titled, Watchdog: Education Department Fell Short in Helping Borrowers When Schools Closed. The Government Accountability Office said the Education Department failed to identify many school closures in a timely way, lessening the discharge options for student loan borrowers. By Lauren Camera, posted August 10, 2022. The Education Department doesn't alert student loan borrowers quickly enough about their eligibility for a loan discharge in the wake of school closures, potentially causing them to suffer financially, a new government watchdog report finds. The Government Accountability Office, the nonpartisan investigative arm of the federal government, found in a new report published Wednesday that the Education Department failed to identify a third of school closures until 2 months or more after the colleges closed, meaning that borrowers impacted by the closures were not told about their loan discharge options until months after that. It did not identify 16% of closures for 6 months or more. Over the past decade, abrupt closures of large for-profit college chains have left hundreds of thousands of students with debt they cannot repay and worthless academic credits they cannot use, Representative Bobby Scott, Virginia Democrat and chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, said in a statement. The report analyzes data on colleges that closed from 2010 to 2020, as well as federal laws, regulations, and documents from the Education Department and 5 out of 8 loan servicers of different types and sizes, which collectively service more than half of all student loan borrowers. Of the 5 loan servicers, 4 used incomplete and potentially confusing information to alert affected borrowers of their eligibility for loan discharge, the report concludes. Moreover, the servicers did not provide the affected borrowers with sufficient outreach on how to secure loan discharge, even after the borrowers, some of whom were at risk of defaulting on their own loans, were notified about their potential eligibility. The Education Department does not ensure that all borrowers are quickly notified after a college closure about their potential eligibility for a loan discharge, limiting the ability of students to make informed decisions about their educational and financial options, the investigators write in the 30-page report. The department has not taken advantage of opportunities to ensure additional outreach is provided to borrowers who are suffering financial consequences for falling behind on loans that are eligible for a closed school discharge. About 246,000 federal student loan borrowers were enrolled at over 1,100 colleges that closed from 2010 through the end of 2020. The college closures ranged in size from small branch campuses to large college chains and included the high-profile shuttering of for-profit conglomerates, such as ITT Technical Institute in 2016, as well as colleges operated by Dream Center Education Holdings in 2019 and by Concordia University in 2020. As has been well documented in the wake of the abrupt closures of for-profit chains that enrolled thousands of students in hundreds of campuses across the U.S., sudden closures often derail students' lives, leaving them with loans but no degree and few options for transferring, depending on the program of study. In fact, a report published last year by the GAO found that 43% of affected borrowers did not complete their program before their college closed, and they did not transfer to another college, meaning that the closures were the end for a student's education. The time period GAO examined was a tumultuous one for borrowers, who were at the mercy of changing administrations and dueling preferences to loan forgiveness. During the Obama administration, the Education Department established what's known as an automatic closed school discharge program, which was set to wipe away the loans of students whose schools closed before they could complete their degree and who did not transfer their credits elsewhere. But the program was blocked during the Trump administration as part of former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos's efforts to limit the amount of federal student loans forgiven. It was temporarily restored by an order from a federal judge after attorneys general from 18 states and the District of Columbia sued DeVos, and then eliminated again when she formally rewrote the regulations. According to the report, the Education Department discharged about $1.1 billion in federal loans for over 80,000 borrowers enrolled in colleges that closed from 2010 through 2020. But documents analyzed by GAO investigators found that Education Department officials have expressed concern that many borrowers are unaware of their eligibility for loan discharge because of insufficient and delayed outreach about the potential relief. The primary cause of the delays in identifying college closures, according to department officials interviewed by GAO investigators, is because not all colleges notify the department when they close as required by law within the 10 days. The reporting failures leave officials to monitor closures through social media or word of mouth among the higher education community. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Why Americans Are Increasingly Dubious About Going to College. An alarming number of people are rejecting college, and it could widen the fissures already polarizing American society. Posted August 10, 2022, by John Marcus with the Hechinger Report. This story about college enrollment decline was produced by the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit, independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education. Even as freshmen nervously arrive on campus for the fall semester, policymakers are grappling with what they say has become an alarming decline in the number of high school graduates willing to invest the time and money it takes to go to college. A little understood backlash against higher education is driving an unprecedented decline in enrollment that experts now warn is likely to diminish people's quality of life and the nation's economic competitiveness, especially in places where the slide is most severe. With the exception of wartime, the United States has never been through a period of declining educational attainment like this, said Michael Hicks, director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at Ball State University's Miller College of Business. There are 4 million fewer students in college now than there were 10 years ago, a falloff many observers blame on COVID-19, a dip in the number of Americans under 18, and a strong labor market that is sucking young people straight into the workforce. But while the pandemic certainly made things worse, the downturn took hold well before it started. Demographics alone cannot explain the scale of this drop. And statistics belie the argument that recent high school graduates are getting jobs instead of going to college. Workforce participation for 16 to 24-year-olds is lower than it was before COVID hit, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, reports. Focus groups and public opinion surveys point to other, less easily solved reasons for the sharp downward trend. These include widespread and fast-growing skepticism about the value of a degree, impatience with the time it takes to get one, and costs that have finally exceeded many people's ability or willingness to pay. There has been a significant and steady drop nationwide in the proportion of high school graduates enrolling in college in the fall after they finish school, from a high of 70% in 2016 to 63% in 2020, the most recent year for which the figure is available, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. The decline is even worse in some states, though not all have data for the same periods of time. The proportion of high school graduates in Tennessee who are going directly to college, for example, has fallen to 53%, down 11 percentage points since 2017. In Indiana, it dropped to 53% in 2020, down 12 percentage points from 5 years earlier, and a pace State Commissioner for Higher Education Chris Lowry has called alarming. In West Virginia, 46% of 2021 high school graduates went on to college the following fall, 10 percentage points below that state's high of 56% in 2010. 54% of 2021 high school grads in Michigan went straight to college, down 11 percentage points from 2016. In Arizona, 46% of high school graduates in 2020 went to college the following fall, a drop from more than 55% in 2017. In Alabama, recent high school graduates' college going in 2020 fell to 54%, down 11 percentage points since 2014. And in Idaho, college going has plunged to 39%, down 11 percentage points since 2017. Americans are increasingly dubious about the need to go to college. Fewer than 1 in 3 adults now say a degree is worth the cost, according to a survey by the nonprofit Strata Education Network, which conducts research into and financially supports ways of expanding access to higher education. That conversation has come up more frequently. Is it worth it? Said Jennifer Klein, a counselor at Festus High School in Festus, Missouri, a state where the proportion of high school graduates going straight to college is down by 6 percentage points since 2017 to 61%. I just have more and more parents who are saying, nope, you're not going to do that. You're not going to a 4-year college. Her students' parents just don't value education the way they did in the past, said Amanda DeBoard, an advisor in a statewide program in Tennessee called AdviseTN. I feel like that's been slipping for a few years. One AdviseTN student who was headed to college, Ever Baladares, said his classmates' parents in the Nashville suburb of Laverne used to tell them, if you don't go to college, you're a bum. That has changed, however. They don't think that anymore. This is being made only worse by a growing unhappiness among recent university and college graduates with the value of the education they received. More than 4 in 10 bachelor's degree holders under 45 don't agree that the benefits of their educations exceeded the costs, according to a survey by the Federal Reserve. Only a quarter in another survey by the educational publishing and technology company Cengage said that if they could do it again, they'd take the same educational path. And we'll cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, New York City Can Reinstate School Budget Cuts, Court Rules. With the first day of school in New York less than a month away, the city is caught up in a contentious legal battle over whether to cut school funding. By Lola Fadulu, posted August 10, 2022. More than $200 million in cuts to the New York City public school budget are back in effect, at least temporarily, after a state appeals court on Tuesday put a hold on a lower court's ruling requiring the city to redo the budget. The appeal was the latest in a contentious back-and-forth over school funding that has pitted Mayor Eric Adams against the city council and provoked rage among teachers and educators. The fighting has set the stage for a chaotic start to a school year that was supposed to be the first normal one after pandemic disruptions. The Adams administration was pleased that the cuts, which the mayor has said were necessary because of failing student enrollment, could be reinstated, according to Amaris Cockfield, a City Hall spokeswoman. We will continue to defend the city's budget process, she said. The exact amount of the cuts has been in some dispute, with Brad Lander, the New York City comptroller, estimating that the cuts actually amount to more than $300 million. More than 1,200 city schools, or around two-thirds of the public schools in the city, will face cuts, according to an analysis by Chalkbeat, an education news site. Many principals have objected to the budget cuts for months, arguing that they couldn't come at a worse time. The 2022-2023 school year was supposed to be focused on recouping losses after the pace of learning slowed during the pandemic. Instead, principals say the cuts are forcing them to slash teaching positions and enrichment programs they need to help students recover. School starts in a few weeks. Our students do not need a drawn-out court fight, said Michael Mulgrew, the president of the United Federation of Teachers. The answer is for the mayor to restore the cuts. The Adams administration proposed the cuts because the bulk of funding schools receive is tied to the number of students they enroll, a number that has been declining steadily. Around 120,000 families have left the school system over the past 5 years, the vast majority during the pandemic. The previous mayor, Bill de Blasio, used federal stimulus funds to bolster budgets for schools with declining numbers. But the Adams administration decided against relying on federal money, which is temporary and will be gone by fiscal year 2025. Teachers and parents have argued that families will continue to leave the public school system if schools lack enrichment programming or have large class sizes because teachers have been let go. A number of teachers and parents sued the education department over the budget in July. They argued that the department made a procedural error when it allowed the council to vote on the budget before the Panel for Education Policy, a governing body largely appointed by the mayor, held a public hearing on it and voted on it. A Manhattan judge sided with the parents and teachers last week, and the city appealed that decision, arguing that tossing out the budget was destabilizing and would force the city to pretend that it was still flush with federal pandemic relief and that student enrollment remains at past levels. The case will be back in court on August 29th, the week before the school year begins. Laura D. Barbieri, a lawyer for Advocates for Justice, which is representing the parents and teachers who sued the city, said the timing of the next hearing would further delay the chaos that the city repeatedly cited in its brief and prevent principals, teachers, and parents from knowing what their school budgets will look like. This final article comes from the Miami Herald, and it's titled, Professors in Florida Are Feeling the Chill from DeSantis's Education Legislation, by Anna Wilder, posted August 10, 2022. Florida university professors are facing unprecedented challenges as a spate of new laws could soon crack down on research, discourse on race and gender identity, and create an environment in which employees feel their political beliefs are being scrutinized at the risk of losing tenure. The measures are backed by Governor Ron DeSantis and the Republican-led legislature, and are seen as just the start by some educators. Those concerns have been fueled by reports that DeSantis had drafted even more attempts to rewrite laws governing public higher education, including stripping university presidents of the ability to hire professors. The underlying message from 8 professors from 4 public universities across the state interviewed by the Miami Herald is this. It is not easy to be an educator in Florida. 2 professors who spoke to the Herald declined to be identified out of their concern for retribution. It isn't just history or politics professors who are worried about the chilling effects of restrictions on academia as they head back to class later this month. It appears to ripple through many academic disciplines. Some professors even suggested that they were considering leaving Florida to teach in other states, and said they knew colleagues who had similar thoughts. In Florida, we know that these policies have really led to increased efforts to silence and surveil academic speech, said Emily Anderson, an assistant professor of international relations and intercultural education at Florida International University. Academic speech matters because it's a fundamental freedom that is really how our university system is grounded. When we have policies that threaten speech, in my view, it shadows threats to all other protected rights. Anderson's work is focused on girls' education, women's work, and how political speech affects the way girls' education is articulated. For Anderson, the measures championed by Republican leaders are a coordinated effort to silence and undo policy reforms that have sought to make environments more inclusive and accessible. It makes me just heartbroken that parents and many people in the community and other education stakeholders are being actively encouraged to distrust and to spread distrust about public education, she said, all based on things that have no empirical basis and no basis in fact or reality. It's all policy theater. This section is called Legislation's Effects on Campus. The Florida legislature passed and DeSantis signed multiple bills that affect education this year. Some, including HB 7, individual freedom, also known as the Stop Woke Act, will determine how race-related issues are taught in public universities, colleges, and in workplace training. The legislature also passed Senate Bill 520, which created an exemption to the state's public records law, allowing a state university or college to withhold information about applicants vying to become president until a final slate of candidates has been decided. Florida International University, among other state universities, is looking for a president. DeSantis signed the bill in March. These bills, however, may only be the start. A 70-page proposal uncovered through public records by Jason Garcia with Seeking Rents sought to strip public universities and colleges of individual autonomy and concentrate decision-making power in Tallahassee under the Board of Governors, which oversees universities, and the Board of Education, which oversees community colleges, Garcia wrote. This legislation has the potential to produce a diminishing effect on universities' rankings, research, and staff, creating an uncertain future for education in Florida, Professor said. In DeSantis' proposed higher education package, the legislation would have given the Board of Governors more authority to investigate university presidents and fire university employees, according to the Seeking Rents article. This is intimidating for professors like Anderson, who say this would feed into the narrative that public universities are untrustworthy. Anderson said this has changed the way she thinks about her classroom space. When teaching, she has become more transparent with her students about what is happening and how the legislation affects her as a professor. She also shares what she sees as a fundamental part of her job, to open up her processes as a researcher and talk about how she finds data. So much of the process of teaching policy and doing policy analysis is really thinking about what the research has to say about a particular issue or area of social concern, Anderson said. Now that facts don't matter anymore, apparently, now that we're all just trying to figure out our own spaces in this, to speak truth to power but also exist in the real threat, that is, a potential loss of job, that is, loss of reputation, loss of all the things you've been working for as an adult. Her classroom setting isn't her only worry. Anderson is up for tenure this summer, which now, through legislation DeSantis signed into law in April, will be reviewed every 5 years by the university's Board of Trustees, making it more difficult to retain tenure. Anderson said even sharing her thoughts on these issues is intimidating with this new legislation, and we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.